Hi, you're listening to Talking About Organizations, a podcast about management and organization studies where we read and discuss foundational texts and key ideas that inform the way we think about organized work today. Talking About Organizations is a community resource graciously supported through contributions by our listeners. To find out more about our program and how you can help, visit our website at www.talkingaboutorganizations.com or stick around to the end for more information. Now, on with the show. Welcome to episode 118, a special episode featuring a symposium conducted at the 2024 annual meeting of the Academy of Management held in Chicago. The symposium was titled Design Choices, Examining the Interplay of Organizational Structure and Digital Technologies, and was organized by Adrienne Baer and Amanda Pratt from Stanford University and our own Pedro Monteiro, who also moderated the session. This is part one of the episode where we present the opening comments and moderated discussion. To learn more about the event, please go to our website at www.talkingaboutorganizations.com. The audio has been edited for clarity and brevity, and some portions have been re-recorded.
Okay, yeah, we're here.
Hello, everyone. Thank you for joining us. My name is Amanda Pratt, and I'm a PhD candidate at Stanford. I'm joined by my co-organizers and co-conspirators in organizing this panel, Adrienne Baer, also a PhD candidate at Stanford, and Pedro Monteiro, assistant professor at Copenhagen Business School. Before I introduce our esteemed panelists, I wanted to frame this panel with a story. I'm currently doing a digital remote ethnography, meaning I'm studying a geographically distributed project team who meets via the company's digital collaboration tools. These collaboration tools come from a large company with many products that are nearly ubiquitous in modern work. And I've been working with the team at my field site since October. It's almost a year. And got into a good rhythm of being able to record meetings and download transcripts. No matter how the meeting was organized, I could record. Regardless of whether I owned and set up the meeting request, or if I was merely an attendee, I was able to download the transcripts for later analysis. Well, folks, all good things must come to an end. In late June, I went on vacation for 2 weeks. When I returned, my field site's collaboration technology suite had been updated. This wasn't an internally initiated change. Rather, the collaboration tool provider pushed a major change to the features and functions in the tool. And as part of these changes, permission to download recordings and transcripts changed drastically. I now could only download transcripts for which I owned the meeting, or if someone made me the co-organizer of the meeting. This included recordings which were made prior to the change. And so now I have to ask every meeting organizer to either add me as an organizer prior to the start of the meeting or give me access to the meeting recordings one by one, recording by recording. Oh, and even this fails sometimes. So, long story short, clearly this has changed my own pattern of behavior as well as how I interact with other members of the organization. Other members of the organization have also reported changes too, such as becoming much more sensitive to how they use recordings and transcripts and changing their interactions patterns with folks in their organization. Hold this story in your mind for a second while we turn to one of the esteemed scholars in our field. A century ago, Weber famously announced, "The systematic, rational conduct of official business requires a system of record keeping that makes possible the precise allocation and monitoring of resources and activities." The ability to download recordings and transcripts is one small example of the multiple and changing ways in which technology systems mediate our bureaucracies, organizations, and institutions. We must ponder how such affects the systematic and rational conduct of business. With that, I'm going to turn it to Adrienne.
Thanks, Amanda. Amanda has detailed an intimate portrayal of how subtle changes to digital features like access permission can start to shape organizational structures. And we all need only think back a few weeks to the CrowdStrike fiasco to understand that feature updates can also cause cataclysmic change across many organizations and industries. It only takes one software engineer who is itching for the weekend, pushing code to production a little too quickly to impact the world. The long-term impacts of this cybersecurity upset on organizational structures will only unfold with time. In this panel, we build on classic work on technology and social structures to consider the various ways in which design and implementation choices impact organizational structures. This raises a set of questions, such as, how does the division of work and hierarchical relations interrelate to what's displayed on a software's primary interface or hidden? Who gets access to different interfaces? And what features are enabled by default? Other questions such as, like, on a broader level, how do these elements affect organizations and organizing? And can such third-party decisions affect how management view their own organization and organizational practices, thus affecting the organization not only through technological limitations, but also by communicating and therefore normalizing various political perspectives on management based on what is displayed where and to whom, what's enabled by default, or what's built into access permissions? We had similar questions in mind when we organized this panel. We thought about who could help us think about these questions. And because these are inherently cross-disciplinary questions with ramifications at both the micro and macro levels, we knew we'd need a cross-disciplinary group to get the conversation started. We are so honored to introduce you to four phenomenal scholars to talk about these issues. Professor Jerry Davis from University of Michigan, Professor Liz Gerber from Northwestern, Professor Melissa Valentine from Stanford, and Professor Ileana Stigliani from Imperial College London, who pre-recorded some remarks for us as she is unable to attend in person today.
Gerald F. Davis is the Gilbert and Ruth Whitaker Professor of Business Administration, Professor of Management and Organizations at the Ross School of Business at the University of Michigan. Dr. Davis's interests are around corporations as a vehicle for social and economic change. Especially relevant to this panel is his work regarding how technology and institutions combine to shape organizations, including his work, Varieties of Uberization, How Technology and Institutions Changed the Organizations of Late Capitalism, with Asim Sina in Organization Theory.
Elizabeth Gerber, Professor of Mechanical Engineering, McCormick School of Engineering, and Professor of Communication Studies in the School of Communication at Northwestern University. Dr. Gerber's research focuses on the role of technology in supporting innovation, in particular what she conceptualizes as collective innovation. Notably, she brings together insights from organizational behavior, human-computer interaction, and design principles to theorize on the role of technical infrastructure in enabling collaborative work. Particularly relevant to this panel is her extensive work in HCI on the development and implementation of technological tools for organized coordination, such as Critiki, a scaffolded approach to gathering design feedback from paid crowd workers.
Melissa A. Valentine is the Associate Professor in Management, Science, and Engineering at Stanford University. Dr. Valentine studies how technology is changing work and organizations. Some of her recent work includes how experts can develop new capabilities and expertise using algorithms. And particularly important to myself and Adrian is that Melissa is also our PhD advisor.
Thanks, Melissa. Ileana Stigliani, Associate Professor of Design and Innovation, Management and Entrepreneurship Department at Imperial College London. Dr. Stigliani's research focuses on collective cognition within and across organizations. Relevant to this panel is her interest in how materiality, or lack thereof, influences how teams make and give sense of new products, services, and experiences. Recent pertinent work includes The Aesthetic Dimension of Organizing, a Review and Research Agenda, in the Academy of Management Annals with Giada Baldessarelli and Kimberly D. Elsbach. I also want to introduce our co-organizer and moderator, Pedro Monteiro from Copenhagen Business School. Pedro Monteiro, assistant professor in the Department of Organization at Copenhagen Business School. Dr. Monteiro's work centers on the organization of collaboration and the management of expertise in the workplace. His work on highly bureaucratic organizations and organizational structures is particularly relevant to how digital technologies affect established, historically analog organizations. And I now turn it to Pedro to kick us off.
Thank you, Adrienne, and thank you, Amanda. When we thought about the symposium, we thought we wanted to have a multidisciplinary panel and something more like a debate and a conversation. And we're going to start with each panelist providing some opening comments on the general topic of the symposium. And we're going to start with Ileana.
Hello, everyone. Ileana Stigliani here. I hope you've been enjoying the Academy of Management meeting and Chicago all together. First of all, I would like to thank Adrienne, Amanda, and Pedro, the organizers of this symposium, for inviting me, but also for allowing me to participate even remotely, even from afar. So I'm very thrilled to share my insights with you. And given the nature of my research, of course, I will talk more extensively about the role that design thinking or design in general plays at the intersection of digital technologies and organizational structure. So I really hope you will enjoy the panel and you will enjoy the discussions that, of course, will be generated by the panelists. And thank you once again.
Thank you, Ileana. Having a video is in itself an interesting insight on technology, organization, and so on. While we continue to meet face-to-face here, well, we are also augmenting this tradition with digital technologies. But I wanted to ask Jerry maybe to start by giving your take on the topic.
Sure. So I'm the person that belongs here least. I don't know anything about design. I'm very opinionated, but I actually have no knowledge. So you can dismiss almost everything I have to say because there's actual experts here. But the title that I selected was The Impact of Institutional Terroir on Organizational Structure Through Technology Creation and Implementation. That pretty much summarizes the whole view. So obnoxiously, I've been cultivating the word institutional terroir because I think it gets at something that's right. It's something about basically the argument is a varieties of capitalism type that national economies contain a set of institutions that shape the way the technology gets implemented. And so you think about the pillars of a national economy, the way they organize labor, capital, supply, distribution, legal forms of organization, education systems, and all these things shape the kind of enterprises you get. That's really clear when you look around the world that the same technology can get implemented in radically different ways. So one of my favorite examples is the three biggest car makers in the world are General Motors, Volkswagen, and Toyota. Volkswagen exists to create good jobs for Germans, and it has 670,000 employees. Toyota exists to ennoble Japan on the world stage. It has 375,000 employees. General Motors exists to create shareholder value, and it has 167,000 employees. So Toyota is almost five times as big as GM, but both making about 10 million cars a year. So that's pretty wild. It's pretty clear that there's national variation. If you look around the world, what are the five biggest employers? They vary radically by country. So I think that's sort of insight number one, you know, but which is attributable to varieties of capitalism, is that national institutions create this terroir within which technology is implemented. And then part two is that digital technologies are not like the others. So it's not like necessarily mass production or the introduction of the copying machine. It sort of gets at those basic pillars. So the way that you raise capital, the way that you the way that you work with suppliers, the way that you work with labor, that it's shifting all of those things as well. And so the way that I think about the issue is that the introduction of new technologies like the web or the smartphone are implemented within that institutional terroir. So you get characteristically different looking organizations depending on the national institutions. But at some level, it can also change the pillars themselves, capital markets, labor markets, and so on. I don't know where to go with that. It's a big old fuzzy thing that feels roughly right. But the paper that was generously mentioned with my recovering doctoral student, Nassim Sinha, looked at like what does Uber or the Uber-like platform look like around the world? And so we sort of, this is playing on a paper that Kathleen Phelan did that I love very much. We compared, look, the Uber model is drivers and riders both have GPS-enabled smartphones, and they find each other for rides. So that's it. That's the entire business model right there. And in the U.S., inevitably, it turns into a way to disempower labor and rapaciously feed the maw of the venture capital world. Like, that's inevitably how it turns out. In Germany, that model just doesn't fly at all. They don't even pronounce it Uber. We look at Nigeria, Indonesia, China, India, and just that model looks radically different. So it's something, a very simple technological business model, there's no inevitability about how it plays out. It sort of depends on the national context. So sorry for going on, but that's the basic punchline.
I just want to say, Jerry, that you do belong here. We wanted to think about design in a broad way. So both organizational design as an area of research and practice in management, but also designers as product or information design, you know, like the practice of design in that way. And on that note, Liz, would you like to share next?
Sure.
So I am trained as a designer, and so I guess I'm legitimate here. Sorry, you don't belong. You don't belong. I belong. And
I'm a 1099. Yeah. You're the W-2.
That's how. We'll just call you that for short. 1099. So thank you, Jerry. So my training was in product design originally. So I made physical products, and I'm going to share a little story about how I came to be in this seat, because I think it's an interesting reflection on how our academic. How we think with each other or don't think with each other. So I was doing product design, and I was remarking that we were constantly making up lay theories of behavioral science and social psychology as designers, right? This is how we have these hypotheses. This is how people work, and therefore we should design the product like this. Or this is how people collaborate, and therefore we should do this. Lo and behold, I was lucky enough to be at Stanford, and it turns out people were studying this, had been for many years. And so I transitioned from doing product design to doing a PhD in management science in the same program that our wonderful organizers are. Can we just give them a round of applause? So hard. You're doing so many things. Thank you for organizing this. So I transitioned to doing a degree in management science at that point. And I was very interested in what's actually the theory of how people behave, right? There's something there. And my PhD advisor at the time said, the thing that's going to be hardest for you is you're going to want to get into this system. So I too was doing an ethnography 18 months, and I saw all sorts of things that were going wrong. And what did I want to do? Fix it. Right? I didn't want to just write about it. I did. I have a PhD. I graduated. But I really wanted to fix it. And so it was this interesting tension that I've had my whole career, which is, how do we apply these theories? And how do we actually develop theories from the technology? And I think there's a real conversation between the two. And so I spent my career trying to be in between the two, both hanging out with and identifying as, now I'm design medium agnostic. I design a lot of software interactions, processes, so much beyond product at this point. But how do I facilitate conversations between how we design things and how we think about how people work and organize? And it turns out there's a huge barrier. And so my goal of being in this very awkwardly constructed room today is to break that barrier and say, we need more conversation between the two. So I'm very grateful that you brought this together. And my particular passion, two passions, one is getting people involved in the design process that haven't historically been. So you can imagine this last, two decades have been a boon for me with crowdsourcing and crowdfunding. And I'm like, just the informal organization is my happy place. And the open organization, very happy about that. And at the same time, I've started an organization myself and designed technology and collaborative software for that organization, and realized that, I think we all know this, but when the rubber hits the road, it's a lot different, right? You have all these visions of how your software is going to work, how your designs are going to work, how people work, and then you put it in the system and it blows up. It doesn't work. And then there needs to be a negotiation between, okay, well, this is actually how we work. So let's redesign the software and whatever it is, the product. It's always imperfect and it's constantly changing. We never get the design right on the first time. And honestly, the hundredth time we don't get it right, because the organizations are constantly shifting. And so the method that I want to promote and that I feel very strongly about is a method called design research, which is a method in which you get to both develop theory as well as product or a solution. And you can do both. And I think I thought you only could do one or the other, design or theory. No, there is a rich space in between. And I think both the product and the theory are much stronger for having been road tested, if you will. So thank you. And I'm going to pass it on to Melissa, who I just want to appreciate that you brought your snacks. Like, you're in it for the haul.
That's
here.
Amanda.
I just want to be like, we're in here all day.
Oh, you don't know who brought them? Oh.
Okay. Well, we got trail snacks, yeah. So we're good for the day.
An emergent resource.
We can keep talking. We can keep talking. So thank you so much for having me. I'm honored to be here.
Okay, so I will also start with a moment of gratitude for this session and sort of context for the gratitude. So I am, for reasons that I can't totally explain, like obsessed with bureaucracy and organizational charts. I think those are the most interesting things that happen in society. I want to know, where do they come from? Who makes them? What are the influence that they have over things like decision-making and resources? Separately, I'm also really interested in technology, software, and data. And those two things, to me, makes so much sense to me that those need to be talked about together right now. But it's not, when I started at the Academy, like 11 years ago, I guess at this point, not everyone was having that conversation. Not everybody understood how intertwined those were. So Jerry Davis was actually the first person I ever heard say API at AOM. Wow. Right? And so like ever since then, all of my jokes about APIs I get from, that's code, software code. So anyway, the first person I ever heard say API at AOM was Jerry. And I was like, I can't believe this like sociologist, like Dean of Michigan is like walking around talking about APIs. And I was like, he gets it. So Jerry's writing and research has been super important. And then I'm so lucky that Amanda and Adrian joined the program, and both of them just have taken the ideas about like org charts and software like so many different directions that I would never have thought of. This program was their brainchild, and they just like your creativity and sort of like innovating from Jerry's ideas that I've played with. And anyway, and then Pedro came to visit at Stanford, and like he was just sitting there talking about bureaucracy, like, and he loves it as much as I do. And anyway, so it's just really exciting. And all of you here, thanks for being here. And let's, yeah, keep talking about bureaucracy and software. Yeah. Do you have an I Love Bureaucracy pin? That's good. That's cool. That's very cool. Okay, so I have 2 points to make to kind of continue the conversation. So I do want to talk about org charts and software. I want to talk first about the conflict. I'm going to tell you about some studies, the conflict between organizational charts and software data. And then I want to talk about how software data augment org charts, just because I think these are interesting ideas to play with. So the first one, in terms of conflict, there are a lot of classic writings in organizational design, organizational structures. Think back to like Herb Simon, thinking about decision spaces. And a lot of the theory around organizational charts and organizational design, I look at how organizational charts divide up decision spaces for human brains. Mm-hmm. And it's super interesting in this day and age to now go back and read that classic stuff, 50s, 60s, 70s, where they're talking about like human decision mm-hmm. spaces. They don't say human decision spaces. They say decision spaces. And it's very focused on how humans have, you know, limited information processing, coordination, complexity, and so forth. So all of that is an assumption of human decision-making, and that's what the org chart really supports. So we have so many theories that really support that idea. So anyways, a study that I did, and Amanda and I just published this if you get curious about it. So the study that we did looked at an organizational chart that was very much focused on human making within human-sized decision spaces. And what happened was some data scientists created an algorithm that basically conflicted with that organizational chart because the algorithm was able to explore across the entire decision space. So this is kind of like just a stylized example, but let's say there were 100,000 decisions that were being made by like 200 people all divided up. The algorithm would rather explore those 100,000 decisions to find an optimal solution within the decision space. So what the algorithm is going to identify as the optimal within that decision space is going to be very different than what's going to happen if you are dividing it up for human decision making. So it was not until I had done that sort of inductive ethnography and seen the data scientists create this algorithm and seen the data scientists be like, oh, uh-oh, because you have like the people org chart and then you have the algorithm. And there was no interpersonal tension there, but there was like structural tension between how the algorithm was supporting decision making and how the org chart was supporting decision making. So it's interesting there, org charts are sort of created by human managers and then algorithms are created by human like data scientists. And right now that tension between those two occupations and that those two kinds of expertise are coming to tension right now in a way that I think is super interesting. So that's conflict between org chart and software data, whatever. And in some ways it's like, oh, that like conflict, shoot, like what is going to be, like, how is that conflict going to play out over time? But I think actually the resolution over time is going to come as we see how data and software augments or enhances the org chart. So you can think of the org chart involves like a human decision maker, a human manager is like looking at how to structure something so that a group of people can specialize and coordinate. What if that human manager had a lot of data actually on what was possible, on like what the problem was, what was possible? Right now, our org charts are very static. So what if the human decision maker had data on all of the org design decisions that they were making? Because typically the org charts are very static. You don't measure the impact of dividing the decisions in a certain way. What if you could model many different ways of structuring the decisions? What if you could measure the impact? What if you could experiment over time, like using algorithmic systems and so forth? There are a lot of studies that give examples of each of those things, of what it's like to measure the impact of the org chart, what it means to use data to design the org chart, what it means to sort of have experiments on how the org chart is functioning over time. So short-term conflict between org charts and algorithms. In the long-term, I hope what we see is augmented org charts as the data supports the organizational designers.
Thank you. So if I hear correctly, it seems that we had a little bit about context from Jerry, a bit on the making of products and the theories and the thoughts behind them from Liz, and also something about features and interplay of technology and use from Melissa. So now we have some questions to animate our debate and help us think about the different challenges of empirically and theoretically making sense of technologies and design. And the first one is about what is old and what is new. And we wanted to start here because, as a community, we tend to be too eager sometimes to jump into the new, to the new things, when we are sometimes victims of the fashions of management. So here's the question. Each generation of scholars face new technology in the workplace, which interact with timeless elements of organizational structure, authority relations, information flows, standardization, task interdependencies, and the monitoring and control of workers. Each of you has a different perspective on digital technology in the workplace, ranging from a macro-level view of its impact on organizational forms down to micro-level interactions of humans designing and using such technologies. So could you please tell us a bit about what you have observed from your vantage points and what new technologies might make us consider about our current understanding on organizational structure? And we're going to start with Ileana.
Well, I think it's quite clear that digital technologies are influencing quite significantly organizational structures. And in my experience, they do so by enabling more agile, more flexible, and more decentralized forms of organization, but also forms of working, ways of working. Let me share an example with you that I've been able to observe firsthand. So for example, Spotify uses agile methodologies, design thinking, and digital collaboration tools to organize their teams as small autonomous squads. So these squads are like mini startups responsible for specific aspects of the service, and they are empowered to make decisions independently. Now, going back to the use of design thinking, they use design thinking in this transformation by helping these teams to stay constantly user-centered, constantly agile and responsive to the changing needs of their audience or their customers. For example, these squads regularly engage in user-centered research, iterative and fast prototyping to refine their products. Now, clearly, given that the way in which creative workers that I study very closely work together, this creates interesting implications for management research, because clearly there is a lot in terms of examining and understanding how these decentralized structures not only impact creativity, the success of, you know, innovations and overall productivity, but also employee engagement, their sense of belonging, their sense of we are part of an organization, even though our teams are completely distributed and decentralized.
Thank you, Ileana. Does anyone wants to follow on that?
I'm happy to follow. With this, when I read this question, it brought me back to the early 2000s when a man named Terry Winograd, who was the advisor to the Google founders, I was working with him, and I was complaining that I was struggling to coordinate schedules with my partner. And he said, "Well, Google just released a new shared calendaring system. And I was like, what? You know, this was like, we were writing calendars on, at best, maybe on a digital device, but usually on paper. And he said, let me show you how it works. I was thinking about that moment. And I mean, Terry is the coolest guy ever and remains much more sophisticated than I in the technology space. But I just thought this, how interesting this is now, the transfer of information and the sharing of information is radically changed. And so while I think many theories of organizational behavior still hold, I think this idea of the ease at which we can access information and we can share information with each other has been an absolute game changer. We can access expertise more readily. We can have expansive views of our identity and who we are and what organizations we're a part of. I'm kind of continually amazed by when I look around the You used to work for one organization and that was your identity. And now because of the ease of sharing information between so many different people, my observation is people have much greater and broader identities and affiliations and associations. And then the last thing I'll say is really about the big tension I'm seeing right now is between social relations and efficiency. A lot of these tools are designed with efficiency in mind. Like, how do you get the information most quickly or how do you organize most quickly? And so actually, to pick a fight with you, because I've already put you down, I'm sorry. When you were talking about these out, like, or how do we have data-informed org chart, mm-hmm. I like got a sick feeling in my stomach because I immediately went to like, oh my gosh, this is going to be optimizing for efficiency over social relations. I'm not saying you're advocating for that, but that was my gut.
Okay. You know, your comment's really a posit here, which is, so thinking institutional terroir, how does that play out here? And I found myself to be unexpectedly sympathetic to transaction costs thinking, which I never would have expected going in. But partly it's because Silicon Valley kind of controls the way that technology gets implemented, and venture capitalists in particular. Ben Chestakovsky has this totally dope new book behind the startup you should all read. But the way that a particular form of hyper-capitalism shapes how technology is implemented and then spreads around the world is really distinctive. Like, there's a lot of, like, imagine all your employees have smartphones and you could communicate with them. Like, one way you could approach that is, oh, we could gather voice and hold votes on things and have collective conversations about what's the right strategy for us and how should we think about this. That would be great. It would be incredibly liberating to use this technology. It's totally open for it to be sort of voice democracy, worker-owned co-ops, and you could, you know, there's a lot of things you could do with the technology, but you know with certainty that advised by neoliberal economists, Silicon Valley and venture capitalists, and Peter Thiel in particular, you know, that they're going to implement it in the most rapacious, cost-minimizing, efficiency-oriented way. It'll never be about voice and democracy. It's always going to be, how do I use this technology to monitor people to the microsecond, to turn them from employees into contractors, if I can do that. I think the latest example, if anyone's shopping for a dissertation topic, this would actually be a pretty dope MSc dissertation topic, if any of you are it's the implementation of pricing algorithms. So I read this morning that Kroger's is now going to have, not only does the price just, it appears electronically on the shelf, but they're going to have facial scanning technology that looks at your age and gender and presumably race and mood at the moment to tell you what your price is going to be. It's like, who would do that? Like, what?
Uber?
Yeah. No, exactly. Like, could you imagine a designer in a civilized country saying, hey, we've got a new technology. Let's use it to come up with prices specific to this person. Oh, you really need to go to the bathroom. $40 for this gallon of milk, you know, that, or Uber, you're in labor, $1,000 to get you to the hospital.
It's called algorithmic wage discrimination.
Yeah.
We've all just had a paper that came out about it.
Yeah, but now that pricing thing, so it's going from wages to what you're charged. So Amazon already did this, but now it's spreading to like grocery shelves to come up with willingness to pay based on technology. It's like, who would do that? And it doesn't have to be that way, but there's something about, like, you know, Uber hired a ton of economists to help them do their evil bidding. Like, how do we use this to implement a neoliberal vision of how this technology will get implemented? It's in no sense built into the technology. It's like the terroir points it in a direction that it doesn't have to go, is my view. So I could be wrong. And Melissa, you actually spend a lot more time in the belly of the beast.
It's true. I think it's hard to, okay, I wish I had gone before you. I agree with all of your points about context and culture. And once you've made a point about like the evil bidding of Uber, I have smaller points to make.
Maybe it's good bidding. I could have gotten the whole thing wrong.
Oh, no. That's not my sense. Let me just sort of focus my comments on the question of old versus new, like what's new about the technology. And I think a more well-trod topic is control. So I have a paper on it. Lindsay has a lot of great research on it. So I think there's more sort of written. It's a little bit more of a mature understanding about how organizations such as Uber are using data software platforms in different ways for control, and then how workers find agency and resistance within that. So I think that conversation is really important. So I'm just double clicking on that. In terms of what I think is a research area where I would like to see more, and this will not surprise you, is I think that organizational science has never been a science. I think that managers have been like truly like designing these like complex organizational systems without a lot of evidence for like the decisions that they're making. We have really, I think, interesting, great research in the 70s about organizational structures. I think strategy does more about organizational structures and kind of influences. But what's so interesting to me now, as I was saying earlier, is those decisions are now all happening on digital platforms, which means we have basically trace data of what the organizational structure actually is, both the formal and the informal, even at very micro levels, who's talking to whom. I'm thinking of like the Microsoft COVID experimental design where they showed like how people were talking to each other, how people were collaborating before and after work from home. That sort of thing, I think, could really like revitalize our field in particular. I think organizational scientists could start to do more science or like experimental science, just more research studies with a lot of data on organizational structures and decision making. So that's what I would love to see in terms of like where we as a field take this. I think studying what managers do, I think we have different advice we could give based on some of the data science that is now available around organizational structuring and decision making. So yeah, that's where I would end it. I'm going to go back to what Jerry was saying. Context and culture matters. All of this could be happening in very exploitative ways. All of this could be happening in very empowering ways. And I think that is much more dictated by culture and context.
That is a great segue, because we want to think more about the ecology in which this is always happening. Jerry was already touching on context, and you were all talking about power and actors and intentions and Silicon Valley and capitalism. And this is going the direction of investigating who is making the design, the choices that are being made. So here is our second question. Organizational scholars have long studied technologies in the workplace. Yet technologies such as communication tools like Slack and Teams, collaboration tools like Asana, Jira, DevOps, or tracking tools like Salesforce Dynamics often are developed largely by an external organization, but selected and configured by management and or IT professionals associated with the folk organization. How might this clearly distinct set of stakeholders affect what tools are selected and or designed and implemented? Which set of stakeholders matters more, in your view, with respect to relationship between technology and organizational structures? And again, we are going to start with Ileana.
Well, certainly, I believe that studying designers, technology designers, or in general designers, offers really valuable insights into organizational design, primarily by highlighting the importance of certain principles, creative problem solving, iterative development, the user-centric approach, of course. And clearly, so given that these principles are so very central to the work of designers, these principles and these best practices can inform how organizations, for example, approach problem solving and innovation. Now, if I think of all the consulting, design consulting companies that I've interacted with, primarily for research purposes, I can see that they work in interdisciplinary teams to tackle complex problems, employing iterative cycles of prototyping and testing to develop, you know, innovative solutions. And I think these can be a very fruitful approach that can be applied to organizational processes, for example, to enhance the responsiveness and adaptability, and again, resilience to change of the new forms of organization. For instance, the cross-functional collaboration that we see in design teams can inspire similar practices in other organizational areas. So I think this is very important because by studying the way designers work and the way designers tackle complex problems can really inspire organizations in creating environments, organizational environments that support continuous improvement and agility, which are so very crucial and important in present times.
Thank you, Ileana. So she did not know when she recorded the message, but she brought a more positive spin to some of the topics we have been debating. And you were all saying that as well, that technology can be designed with different goals, with different purposes. So does anyone want to go next?
I'm going to go first because I'm actually going to quote Jerry before Jerry can quote himself. So when I give, I love this question. And I teach a class that's like future of work or something, whatever, for undergrads. And one of the first slides that I have actually is Jerry's face. And the quote, organizational design is now a subfield of computer science. And in your keynote, when you first were introducing APIs to AOM, you were saying, like in organizations at this point, you can have like a data scientist, you can have somebody who's like writing a line of code, and that line of code is organizational design. It does actually design the platform that will say who's talking to who has access to what resources. So organizational design is now a subfield of computer science, which means if we're interested as organizational scientists, if we're interested in organizational design, that means that we have to go get interested in the people writing the code that is structuring the organization at this point. So stakeholders to get interested in, I think, are the data scientists, the software designers, especially for like work platforms. Second point on this, I'm going to now quote my office neighbor, Bob Sutton, who's your advisor, in fact, yeah. So Bob Sutton has a quote where he says, given how complex organizational structures are, and then given how complex the software that organizations use at this point, organizations are now so complex that managers do not and cannot understand the systems that they're managing. There's no way to understand the interplay between organizational design and software at this point. Final story kind of example to illustrate that. I've been studying something called IPaaS, which is integration platform as a service. So think of like software as a service, something like SAP or so organizations now have literally thousands of software systems that are helping them coordinate. So think of like a CRM, like a customer relationship management service, enterprise risk platform. So those two software systems have to talk to each other. So organizations like over time accumulate thousands of software vendors like that. And so now there's new software vendors called IPaaS, integration platform as a service. There's one called Boomi, if you are interested in this. So they actually help all of those software systems now talk to each other. So we're like accumulating software systems to help coordinate the organization over time. And there's no human mind that can understand that system, which I think is fascinating. So I'm saying study the data scientist, and also that entire ecosystem, I think, could be studied, like all of those thousands of coordination software systems that organizations use.
How much do I have to know to be able to understand that? Like how much training does one need to be able to...
I think for the kinds of research that, so I really like to do field research, which means you go into an organization and you sort of embed with somebody who's operating within this system. And I think that kind of research approach, like, really gives you sort of a focal vantage point from which to be looking across all of it. I think toggling between the organizational vantage point, where you're keeping in mind the thousands of little like software systems that different teams have adopted, and toggling between like that vantage point and then the team vantage point, I think any of us could do. I think you just have to be smart and pay attention. Yeah. Sorry, that's what I said. Just pay attention. That's all.
That was good. Did you drive here from Ann Arbor?
I took the train.
I think you're capable.
Okay.
Like, I mean, really, like, I think too often, like, computer scientists, of which I have one foot in, we use it to protect ourselves, right? We use these big terms that nobody can understand to keep others out, but it's... You know, there's, you don't, I think literacy, I think we all need literacy in this space, like, no matter who you are, whether you study them or not, tech literacy is critical, but I don't think it's not quite that difficult. I mean, to get in the weeds and really do it, sure, but to understand it, no.
But you should know what API stands for.
For sure. Yeah, but Jerry will tell you.
Or maybe not what it stands for, but just what it does, if you want.
I was going to say some context stuff, so you...
Oh. I think the first thing I want to bring up is that I think we're giving an incredible amount of credit to data scientists and designers in this. And I think the interesting set of stakeholders that hasn't really been mentioned here is the sales teams. Like, what are the promises that people are making to get these software in? There's a great story out there in which a big software system was being sold into an organization and they promised all these, you know, efficiencies, et cetera. This was the salespeople talking, but the data scientists knew it wouldn't really be quite that helpful. But the people wanted to buy into the promise of it. But the salespeople did say, you know, it will take a little getting used to. And so they handed them, they gave everybody these tchotchke punching bags, like, knowing that's how frustrating it was going to be, but eventually they were going to realize the efficiencies. Well, they never got past the punching bags. Like, it was so inefficient. So I think the sales, like, the promises that we're making would be interesting group to study.
So Harry Braverman wrote this famous book, Labor and Monopoly Capital, in the 70s. Yeah. And he talks about how, you know, capitalism inevitably de-skills labor, and just built into the very process is de-skilling and crushing unions. And then the critiques are like, don't believe the ads in the industry magazine when the salespeople say, crush your unions, de-skill your labor force. That doesn't mean it actually happens. That's just, you're believing the propaganda of the salespeople, but that's not what happens on the shop floor. So that's one callback. The other is Mark Zabrocki's dissertation, where hundreds of companies claim that they're adopting TQM. You know, we're adopters of TQM. Yeah. And then when you look at what they actually do, it's like, we have a half hour lunch meeting where we talk about stuff. We call it a quality circle. It's like, the adoption of technology is so varied and so different from what the propaganda says. So it's great to hear these same themes sort of recur. One last MSc graduate is Bob Eberhardt. He did some work on the way that antitrust is going to really shape how this stuff works. Mm-hmm. Like, right now, we're living through an era where the rules are changing in ways that we had not expected. So Bob did this lovely study, I think, with Chuck Easley on bankruptcy laws in Japan and how changes in bankruptcy laws really shifted the prospects for entrepreneurs and the attractiveness of starting a new business. And I think we're in a moment like that here after the Google antitrust case, but also lots and lots of landlords use pricing algorithms that are basically a form of collusion across landlords. I don't know where I'm going with that, but it is sort of a form of sort of technology being implemented in ways that is either that its legality can change because of the broader policy environment. So even shop floor level decisions can be shaped by sort of big policy level changes that are worth tracking. But I say this partly because I went to business school. I never heard a word about antitrust before, like, ever. Right? My entire career, no one mentioned it. And I'd say the entire field of strategy is premised on thwarting antitrust and doing things that would probably be illegal as unfair business practices. Yeah, so just another set of policy things to think about and the way the technology gets implemented.
We thank the organizers Adrienne Baer, Amanda Pratt, and Pedro, and all the guest speakers. Ileana Stigliani, Gerald Davis, Melissa Valentine, and Elizabeth Gerber for making this event a tremendous success. We also thank the Academy of Management for allowing us to record and present this symposium. And that concludes the episode for today. Thank you for listening. The views expressed are those of the speakers and do not necessarily reflect those of their respective organizations or institutions. We hope that you enjoyed the conversation and found it valuable. If so, please consider subscribing through your favorite podcast service and you won't miss an episode. We also welcome your feedback, so if you liked or didn't like something, or have a correction or suggestion for us, please get in touch with us via LinkedIn, Facebook, X, or our website, www.talkingaboutorganizations.com. Also, please consider contributing to the program by buying us a coffee at www.buyusacoffee.com/TAOP. That's www.buyusacoffee.com/TAOP. Your support is greatly appreciated as it allows us to continue providing great conversations about the classics of organization studies. Again, thank you for listening, and we hope to see you for the conclusion of this episode here on Talking About Organizations.